Last question. Thank you very much for teaching us such a. It has been great, and we are truly blessed. Sadhu. I wasn't doing anything, so I might as well get bored in my room meditating all the time. So I might as well come out and teach you. Something to do. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. I often think a lot and have some fear or worry whenever I need to go somewhere and do something. How can I overcome this problem? Have some fear or worry whenever you need to go somewhere and do something. Don't go anywhere, don't do anything. You don't have any worries. Fear or worry whenever you go somewhere. I don't know what you're worried about, because nothing's going to happen to you. Except you get old, and you get sick, and you die. We're all going to do that sooner or later. So I said the other day, this is going to happen to me. So, sometimes what are you fear of? What you're worried of? And a lot of times, if you just write it down and say, what am I worried about? And then do some research, what's the chance of it happening? It's very minimal. So basically, there's nothing to be afraid of. Nothing to worry about. Instead of, remember, fear and worry is looking at the future with a negative mind. Seeing the two bad bits in the future. And not realizing in the future there's 998 good bits. So, why destroy the present by worrying about a future which never happens? I've been meditating for many years now, although on and off. Which is more off or more on? That's the problem. When I meditate, I do feel calm and peaceful. I've never reached a stage of limitless enjoyment. Excellent! Just forget about the images and jars and wait for them to come to you. Is that bad? No, it's excellent. I feel contented and peaceful until I have to. Exactly. Well done. So you don't have to. It just happens. So where's the start? I enjoy worldly activities like diving and mountain trekking. Don't you do worldly activities? Diving. I dive into meditation and I go up to the peaks of insight. That's the same, isn't it? What do you mean? Well, like diving and mountain trekking, etc. Wouldn't it mean I can't enjoy the seven worlds of Buddhist wisdom? I have to spend my entire time to meditate, get away more than 5 centuries. Once I take jhana, I'm not all interested in my hobbies. I find it depressing. Thinking about it is depressing. But no, it's one thing which surprised me, but it was an important point. If ever you look at these poems of the enlightened monks and nuns from the time of the Buddha, there's still no real good translation of that available. It's called the Theragata or Therigata. You find in there all these enlightened monks and nuns who write great poems about the wilderness and being in nature and being in the mountains. And I thought, isn't that indulging? But then later on, the monastic life, no. Because that particular pleasure you get in nature is not that dangerous, because we all know we can't control our own nature. You can't control the mountain and take it back home with you. You go there and enjoy it and then leave it. So it's not sticky like many other pleasures. You know, that sexual attraction may want to find and own that person. Have a relationship with them. If it's material things, you see this beautiful dress, you want to buy it and own it. The wonderful thing about nature is you can't own nature. You all understand that. You can't take the waves and take them home with you. There was that fellow King Canute who decided he was so powerful, he decided to see if he could order the tide to go back and not come in. I think that in a previous life, Mr. Trump was at King Canute. So he was so powerful, he could order the tide to what to do. You can't control nature. You can't order nature what to do. So because of that, it's not so much of a problem doing things like diving or doing mountain climbing, because you can't own it. you can't take it home again. Imagine, what are the skillful means to practice self-awareness of the present moment? I was going to say get dementia, but that's not really skillful. Practice self-awareness of the present moment is just give the present moment more importance. Because we always have the idea that by thinking about the past, we learn from the past. We don't. Otherwise, people would be so wise by now. All your wisdom comes from the present moment. You learn from the present moment, not by the past. That's where you learn everything. And we always think we can have a safe, happy future by planning it. It doesn't work. So spend more time in this present moment. You learn much more from the present moment, and also you learn how to be happy in the future and safe and contented by putting your attention in the place where the future is being made, right now. So the skill for me to practice self-awareness of the present moment is first of all getting into the present moment, and really in the present moment, really right in the middle of the present moment, you haven't got time to speak. You haven't got time to think. Because the next moment is upon you straight away. So we don't need a commentary. If you want to try this, if you like sport, when you go home and you watch a sports match on the TV, turn the commentary off. Mute your TV set. So you can just see it. Why do you need a commentary? You know that the ball's gone in the goal. Or you know that they've won the tennis match, or they've won the cricket, whatever you follow. What do you need a commentary for? So see if you can observe without giving things names or saying about it. And also, it's interesting, if you want to watch a movie, try watching a movie with the sound turned off. See how interesting it is. It's the sound, especially the music, which actually gets your emotions and pulls you in. And the score of the movie, and of course the dialogue as well. So try experimenting, turning off the sound when you watch the TV. And then that shows you just how silent awareness is more powerful than when you have a commentary. How detached from someone you love, husband, and not clinging on to him so much? It is to detach from someone you love them. But if you love them, you have to do something like my father said. Son, the door of my heart's open to you. No matter what you do, even if you go away, I'll always love you. It was a love which was unconditional, without strings attached. Just because you detach doesn't mean you don't love somebody. You love them from this wonderful sense of freedom, letting them go, and they'll always come back again. So someone who, you see this often in relationships, somebody loves their partner so much, the partner feels stifled, feels like in a prison, the person is so afraid about them. So the best way to love is actually to love and let the person go, and he always come back again. I hope you love me. If you love me, you let me go tomorrow, and then I might come back. But if you try changing me, as soon as I get out of here, we'll always escape, I'm coming back again. That is actually how you love somebody. If we can attain stillness just by being mindful of the breathing, why do some people choose to meditate on a rotting corpse or rotting body parts? These common because they're weird. Why do you want to meditate on a rotting body corpse? Just look at yourself in the mirror. That's rotting. Just don't brush your teeth for a few days. Don't shower. Then you try that. Try not showering for a few days. Ugh, it stinks. So the only thing is that people are just really overly attached, you know, to bodies. You know, then it's good to actually to see what a body really is. Now, yeah, we have to keep going. This beauty is not permanent. This pleasure is not always going to be there. So it just takes away a lot of your attachment to the body. Now, there's many supermodels, as well as myself, who are Buddhists. Somebody said that Kate Moss, she's a supermodel, she's a Buddhist and goes on meditation retreats. And one of my friends actually went on a retreat. And Kate Moss was on that retreat. Now, Kate Moss is a supermodel. And so as soon as he found out, wow, Kate Moss is on this retreat, he looked out for her. Which one is it? She looked, where is she? And he couldn't find her. And it was a very powerful experience for him, because Kate Moss, the person, is just ordinary. You would notice her. But Kate Moss, the supermodel, that's what you see when you have the hairdo, all of the makeup, and the lighting, and the airbrushing. Because the pyramid, what it was explained to me, that she's like this amazing canvas where, you know, the makeup artist, the stylist, and the airbrusher can make anything you want. And that's why she's a supermodel. But in real life, she's just ordinary. So much so they didn't even notice her. She's on her retreat, couldn't find out which girl it was. Fascinating. So all this idea of beauty, this isn't the eye of the beholder. How Kuan Yin relates to the Buddha? How Kuan Yin relates to the Buddha? It's Kuan Yin, interestingly, you know, Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, had two chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana. And it's supposed to be all the past Buddhas, all the future Buddhas also have to have two chief disciples. And so when the Amitabha Sutta arose, Amitabha had to have two chief disciples. And one of those chief disciples was called Avalokiteshvara, who was male. The other chief disciple was called, does anyone know? It was Vayama. Struggle, effort, striving. Those were supposed to be the two chief disciples of Amitabha. And Amitabha was a very, I'm going to be a bit coarse here, a good product to market. And so was Avalokiteshvara, isn't it? Looking down with compassion on beings. But by arm and effort, struggle, people didn't like that. So that actually got forgotten. And that Avalokiteshvara became so popular as a as a symbol of compassion. I think this is why I'm getting her own back or something. Sorry, my arm, you're okay. Avalokiteshvara got so popular, became an object of devotion by himself. But when Buddha went to China, Avalokiteshvara did a gender adjustment and became embodied in statues as a female. So if you see the ancient statues of Avalokiteshvara, it's male. But the modern ones are all female. So it became an object, a symbol of kindness and compassion, which Vayama struggled to really have. Amitabha means like boundless radiance. If you want to experience Amitabha, get into the nimitta state, boundless radiance, mind state. So anyway, those were the names, symbols, and they became real by themselves. People actually believe in those things. And you can't demean such people, because I know many of the Vietnamese refugees in Australia who, you know, talk to them, they're honest and they said it's actually happened. They were lost in the ocean, escaping after the Vietnam War. They're on these seas, getting nowhere, being robbed of all their possessions, about to die. And many of them, they saw Avalokiteshvara coming over the waves just as He was defeated in the temples. And then straight after that disappeared, a British frigate which took them to Hong Kong. And they said they saw that. It was real. They weren't hallucinating. And many people saw it as well. So, is it real? Is it fake? It doesn't really matter. It's a skillful means. Skillful means to arouse kindness and compassion. So, yeah, it doesn't really matter. With artificial intelligence developing now, how can we know if it is conscious, if it makes mistakes? As I said, that's why we know if it's real intelligence or not. Intelligence, we make mistakes because that's how we learn and grow. That's how new ideas happen. Things mutate, makes mistakes, and sometimes they mutate in a way which is a successful mutation. And that particular mutation is successful and it grows and strengthens. Other mutations don't. So artificial intelligence has to mutate, has to have that freedom to make mistakes and try many new things, and many times it's errors, so it can learn much more than it knew before. So I think the ability to make mistakes and learn from them, I don't know if that's actually programmed in, but if it is, then that is starting to become intelligence. The enlightened one extinguished when achieved nirvana. There is another religion that promises eternal life with loved ones if you believe in love with God. Is that not a better deal? How many of you really want to live an eternal life with your husband? Isn't one life enough? That might be hell for you. How many with your abusive, say, an abusive relationship with your father? Does that mean you have to live with him? Oh my goodness. On the surface, eternal life would be wonderful. But when you start to contemplate it, eternal life would be one of the greatest punishments. I never saw this movie, but it was around when I was allowed to watch movies. It was a Frankenstein movie, but no, not just a horror just to try and stimulate your fear. But it was a very smart depiction of Dracula. And it depicted Dracula as cursed with eternal life. But as long as kept out of the sun, when he went out at night time, then Dracula would survive forever. There's no reason for Dracula to die. And this person who made the movie, I forget who it was, but they were wise enough to realize that this was a great dilemma, which was torturing the life of Dracula. He'd been around for 300, 400, 500 years, literally been there and done that. And he was afraid of dying, but he was equally afraid of living. Another day, what's the purpose of living for eternity? Everything in your bucket list you've done 100 times. So in the end, he was torn between basically allowing himself to be taken outside into the sunlight so he could die, and his fear of death. And his fear of living for eternity eventually overcame his fear of death, and he went outside willingly to die. Eternal life is not a pleasant thing. Apparently it was a Groundhog Day movie where this guy kept being reborn again and again and again and again on the same day, trying anything to kill himself. So, eternal life, is that what you really want? Number two, eternal life can't always be pleasant. Because if it was very happy, pleasant, you would not notice it anymore. You take it for granted. When my father died, my mother moved into another council apartment, and state-subsidized housing, on the 40th floor of a tower block. It's now called one of the Sink Estates. But at that time, you know, we got up the foot and we couldn't stop looking out the window, had these amazing views over London. for about 1 or 2 days, and then we never looked through the window again. We got used to it, took it for granted. It wasn't special anymore. And people would visit, and they go, "Wow, what a wonderful view," is it? Because after a while, pleasures are taken for granted. We don't notice them anymore. They don't stimulate us anymore. So because of that, just if you can devise a heaven now, after a while, it's just ordinary, boring, so what? The only time you really feel healthy is when you've just overcome a sickness. Otherwise, you take it for granted. You don't notice it anymore. It's always there. Your mind only notices things which change. Without change, they vanish, they disappear. So if the level of pleasure, happiness, in any eternal realm is always the same, you turn off, you disappear, the mind stops. So people who believe in eternal happy life, they're just not much intelligence. They never really thought it through. It's not a better deal after a while. Just like that Dracula movie. I'm sure there's other movies of eternal life superheroes who are just eternal, and they're just looking for any excuse, any reason, any way to stop the curse of eternal life. In the final hours of a person in the hospital bed, the nurse wants to administer morphine to ease the pain. Should we decline the morphine in order to remain lucid when meeting the final journey? No, take the morphine. The reason is that, number one, it can be so painful and traumatic that your final moments will be conditioned by that negativity and also by the just exhaustion of fighting very strong, painful feelings. And there's no need to do that. You take the morphine and then you have dullness, you don't know what's going on, except at those final important moments, when you become free from that morphine. It is the mind separates from the brain. The brain is affected by the morphine, not the mind. And it happens very often in the last moments of life. You've been in a coma, you've been drugged to the eyeballs literally with morphine, and the last few moments is still morphine in the system, but you open your eyes, you wake up, you lucid, you remember everything, even if you have dementia, those last moments are clear. The mind frees itself from the body. There's been lots and lots of examples of that. For those of you who were at one of those talks which I gave, organized, I think, by Bodhinyana, by Angie, had a talk about end of life. I forget who the doctor was. It's a member of the Buddhist Fellowship. He was in palliative care, just describing what happens as you die. And I was supposed to describe what happens after you die. And one of the things I said, I've seen this, I've heard it, many people at their last moments are pain-free, drug-free. They come out of their comas, and maybe only for a few seconds, it can be longer than that. And I asked the people in the audience, and mostly nurses and doctors, how many of you experienced that? A lot of hands went up. It's very common in the last moments of life, even if you have dementia, you open your eyes and say, "John, where have you been all this time? How are you? We've come to see you for years, Mum. We haven't recognized him, but she does now." Or they're being in the coma and come out the last few moments. It's very common. And because that is the truth of the matter, when you die, the brain finishes and the mind is very clear. And that is where all the good practice you've been done all your life, the last 2 or 3 years are just like wiped out because you've been in a coma or really sick, or the last few days because you've been in morphine, then that just doesn't count. You're clear again. So please take the morphine and you will be clear at the very end. And it counts. seems you like Hitler more than Donald Duck. No, I always bounce. Ajahn Chah used to say this, when he sees someone leaning to the left, he tells them to go to the right. When they're leaning to the right, he tells them to go to the left. This is why this whole story of Nasruddin, he had a son who helped him in his business, which was a salt trader. And so whenever he had the donkeys packed with salt, big bags on either side, if they crossed a narrow bridge, if the donkey was leaning to the left, about to fall off the bridge, he would tell his son, push the donkey to the left. Because whatever the father said, the son would always do the opposite. Have you ever had children like that? And if it was leaning to the right, the father would say, push it to the right. And the son would push it to the left, thereby it would be balanced. And one day they were crossing the bridge, and the donkey was leaning to the right, and the father said, push it to the right. And the son actually did that. Push it to the right, the donkey fell in and lost all the salt. What did that for? Don't you remember, Daddy? Today is my birthday. I'm an adult now, not a teenager. And that was a funny story from the Middle East, 800 years ago. Kids don't change. So, if people have got too much aversion to somebody, and I just use Hitler as an example, and that causes a lot of hate and ill will, a lot of upset, then deliberately look for other features which do not arouse sort of anger or vengeance. And then you can always find them. It's actually a restraint of the senses by actually pointing them in a direction which doesn't allow ill will, anger, hatred, or the opposite, lust of wanting and wanting to possess. Doesn't allow those things for you to dominate your mind. Anyway, just kidding, really bad joke. Anyway, just wanted to thank you for the wonderful sharing in this retreat. In fact, had an amazing first Doctor Who time travel experience during this morning's meditation session. Better than the 3D IMAX at Shaw House Theatre, Singapore. Side to side to side. Yeah, you have. Why can't you have a good time when you meditate? What's wrong with that? Why can't religion be fun? Why can't you have a lot of joy and also be more harmonious and kinder afterwards? That's, you know, what I was saying this morning, in that, this afternoon, in that gradual training. Where that first started off was in the Samanya Pada Sutra, the fruits of the holy life. And that's where the king asked the Buddha, said, what are you doing this for? You know, you could be enjoying yourself instead of just having a few robes and sleeping rough. That's where the Buddha said, no, I have more happiness than you do, king. Now, how can you say you've got more happiness? You've got nothing. I've got, you know, whatever I want, whatever fruit, whatever. And that's actually where the Buddha said what your happiness is. Not from material wealth. Is this beautiful inspiration and meaning in your life? The purpose, goodness, keeping precepts, being kind, being generous, that gives you so much happiness. It's not getting money, it's sharing it. Sharing your time. You know, helping somebody, opening the door up. I love opening the door for you, and sometimes you like opening the door for me. Your happiness, like simple things. You get more happiness from that and going to Shaw House Theatre, whatever it's called. And also just by being a good person, being kind, not hurting other people, not deceiving them. That really inspires other people and inspires you. You're a pure-hearted person. You feel that gives you lots of happiness in your life. People ask me, I didn't need to be a monk, I wasn't hopeless, I had a good career, a smart brain, good credentials. I was really handsome when I was young. But, why did you throw it all away and become a monk? Because it was a happier lifestyle. I enjoyed it. So, in the sutras, is there any mention of microorganisms and plants where they have any consciousness? Thank you for being such an inspirational, motivational coach. yet affirm the non-dual goodness of Christ. There's one student that's repeated, so where the Buddha actually says that even clouds have a rudimentary form of consciousness. It's only just a basic form. But of course, you also know if you've done your science, it's very hard to actually draw a line. What's plant, what's animal? You have like the Venus flytraps or something. Animals and plants, which are almost not yet, they have many characteristics of, you know, we call animals, many characteristics of plants. And it's hard to actually draw a line between just those different types of organisms. And so, maybe you can get reborn from grass. To something even better. This is another terrible joke. Imagine that class. Because you know that sometimes there's always economic crises in some countries, recessions. Sometimes people lose their jobs and they're very poor. And this was once this guy, a very rich guy, going home from the office, was driving his Rolls Royce and he saw someone in a poor area of town eating grass. So what else are you doing? He said, I lost my job, lost all my savings, so this is all I've got to eat is rice. And the man, a big businessman in his Rolls Royce, said, well, I can help you. Please come to my house and I can feed you. He said, but look, I've also got a wife and three kids. He said, where are they? They're just around the back. He said, bring them along too, there's plenty for all of you. And so the rich man took him to this huge mansion with extensive grounds and lots of lawns, and he took them out of the car and said, here you are, you can eat my lawn. Plenty of food for all of you. A really nasty business. Anyway, I thought that was funny, spitly. Maybe I've got the spitly said to you in my house. But anyway, what's the question you asked about? Oh, yeah. Plants, yes. So plants, yes, they have got some rudimentary consciousness. So be careful when you eat the carrot. Make sure it is free-range carrots, organically grown. And just say sorry to them before you cut them up. Some people actually go a bit over the border. But yes, sometimes some plants are very, very close. To beings, especially trees, big trees. It's in Buddhism, they see these big trees, you've got to, you know, look after them. This was a story, first couple of years in Perth. There was a Malaysian girl married to an Australian with two children. And the husband wanted to cut down the big tree in the garden. And that night the Malaysian girl had a dream. Not to cut the tree down. So she told her Australian husband that some spirit in that tree came to see me last night in the dream and said, don't cut me down. And Australia, being totally anti-religion, got out a chainsaw and cut it up that morning in front of the wife and the kids. And then, just to prove a point, asked the two children to urinate on the tree stump. And the reason we know that is a couple of days later, that the two children got urinary infections, both of them, and the husband was diagnosed with cancer. And so, you know, Malaysian Chinese, she came to see our temple and say, what's going on here? Is this a coincidence? What's happening? And it was my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, I was just listening in. He said, chances are that there was a spirit there that warned you, and you didn't take heed. What can I do? My husband doesn't believe anything in that stuff. So he gave the good advice. This next day when your husband's out of work, don't tell him. Get some candles, incense, flowers, ask forgiveness of that tree. Ask forgiveness first. And get your children to do the same. Don't tell your husband. Because, you know, he will probably think you're crazy. And she did that, and children's urinary infections cleared up almost immediately. We never found out what happened to her husband in the story. But places like that, is that coincidence? I don't think so. You have those warnings, that's why. If there's any big tree which for one reason or another you have to cut down, please ask forgiveness first of all. So you have to listen, explain the reasons why. because sometimes those trees do have bees living in them, not just birds. So be careful. In Chinese custom, we have many prayers to provide for the deceased, such as Chen Ming. Is it correct from Buddhist point of view that these rituals does not help the deceased? How long does it take for them to be reincarnated again? The only evidence which I can say is the evidence of that psychic research society, ghost practice. They never find ghosts no, older than 200 or 300 years. And that's maybe the maximum. So it does seem that after 200 or 300 years, the ghosts move on. They're not there for that long. So, how much it takes them to reincarnate again is that when they feel like they should get reborn again. It's basically up to them, and of course, like if you want to know what it feels like to be a ghost, you've all had, I've had those experiences, you sleep at night and you dream and you're not quite sure whether you're alive or whether you're dead. You know, it's sometimes in a dream, you know, where am I, what am I doing? And that's similar, that, you know, very deep dreams where you're a bit confused, am I alive, am I dead? That's actually how a ghost feels. They're not really clear about where they are, what they're supposed to be doing. So that's one of the reasons why, that if you can, just remind them they're dead. You're not alive anymore. You're dead. So just that realization, they know that they are dead, it's time to move on. But sometimes all they need is to move on to a new life. And that's all those rituals. Sometimes it helps the people who are dead, but every time, always, it helps the people who do that ritual by extending some love and care to the people, your ancestors, without whom you would not be here. So, for me, it's really irrelevant whether it reaches your parents, grandparents or not. What is really important is you still remember them and show your gratitude and kindness. A few years ago I stayed in Wat Nanachat for a week. It was a very hard time. Couldn't sleep at night, always sleeping during sitting meditation. Couldn't get any calmness in mind. In contrast, here it's comfortable, easy to calm down the mind. Excellent. However, I believe we can get more good karma by doing hard things in Wat Nanachat and doing easy meditation here. What's your thoughts on this? People always think that no pain, no gain. If it's very hard and difficult and you endure, you make lots of merit. That is Gomaya. All you do if you stay there, you don't get anything. Can't sleep at night and sleep through sitting meditation. You know what you actually do when you go back home is just be worse than when you left. You just learn how to sleep while you're sitting up. And that's not very good when you're at your office and the boss catches you sleeping when you're supposed to be working. And not being able to sleep at night, that makes you sick. One of the things which changed me, one of the monks I grew up with decided to do the really, two stories here, really ascetic practices. We decided to only eat what he got on arms round, not to lay down at night. And I forget what other ones he was doing. It's called the Dutanga practices, if you look at it in the books. He tried to do as many as he possibly could. And it was just about 3 or 4 months before I arrived in Wat Nanachat, arrived in Thailand, sorry. And he was staying at a monastery. Ajahn Chah came, and this monk had an epileptic fit and fell off the little stage and just cracked his head open, had to be sent to hospital. When Ajahn Chah saw that, he said, "You Westerners, you're trying far too hard. Just take it easy. You're going to extremes thinking that you're tough guys," because that's actually how many people get trained. Struggle, push. And that's not the way. The other monk, he was decided to do the all-night meditation without moving. Doesn't matter how painful it was, he was going to sit through. He did it. He lasted all night. Didn't move at all. But in the morning, he had to move into a hospital. I always remember that, double knee reconstruction. Crazy. You know, pain is telling you something. Pain is telling you you're going too far, move. But people have this weird idea, you can push through pain and you can conquer pain. It's all ego and sense of self controlling. I am bigger than nature. You work with nature, you don't fight it. So, here we go. What's your opinion on Ajahn Mun's practice? It was known that he could communicate with arahants who passed away long ago during his meditations, mentioned Ajahn Mahapur's book. As it is not contradict the Buddha's teachings? Exactly, it's contradicting the Buddha's teachings. And that's not Ajahn Mun's practice, that is Ajahn Mahapur's interpretation of it. And it's not Ajahn Mun. And anyway, one of the teachings I did get from Ajahn Mahapur, I went to visit all these teachers, stayed with them, learned from them. And at that time, my Thai was perfect. I could understand everything. But many of the Thai monks never knew that, so I would listen to them and see what they were saying. And they thought I could understand a word they were saying. I was like a spy getting lots of information on what they were up to. But one night when I was there, Ajahn Mun said he wanted to give a talk. And he said, especially for the new Western monk who came down, for me. And I've seen that's actually been published in some books. It was obviously a very good talk. But what I always remember from that was Ajahn Mahapur saying he had malaria. Everyone had malaria in those days. And in the middle of a fever, if you've ever had any of those really strong fevers, you know, just no energy, shaking, sweating like anything. And he decided to be tough because the bell went for the work period, which is usually sweeping. So in the middle of a malaria fever, he used his willpower, the tough guy, got up from his mat, walked down the stairs of his hut, grabbed a broom and started sweeping in the middle of a fever. That's how tough he was. Do you respect monks like that? Ajahn Mun didn't. As soon as he saw him, he criticized him. This is not the practice of a Buddhist monk. You shouldn't do that. You can get back up to your heart and lie down. The job of a Buddhist monk is to investigate, understand, use wisdom power, not control. And that was great coming from Ajahn Mahapur's own mouth. Because he was saying this is not the way that Ajahn Mun practice, not through force, through wisdom power. So that bit about Ajahn Mun talking to arahants, that is total gomaya. Dear Ajahn, how do I practice mindfulness in daily life? Now is the most important time, the one in front of you is the most important person in care. Do that with your customers, do that with your boss, or with the people who work for you. It becomes very successful. I don't know if I really should say this, but I think Gerald knows that I taught with Emperor's Three Questions a long time ago at Cathay Pacific, and the HR manager took that on board as part of his training program. I would say that that was so successful, but apparently Cathay Pacific has almost got bankrupt and is that replacing many staff. But it wasn't my fault, it was not the Emperor's Three Questions that did that. The Emperor's Three Questions was actually part of the strategies which worked. So that's how you practice mindfulness in daily life. Now the most important time. Stop wasting your energies too much about the future past. The one in front of you, imagine like a flight attendant looking at you. You really know that they're giving you importance. My most memorable